got some microphones, right? Do we have some microphones in the to be circulating around? This man in yellow, he's got something written on there. Weed out hate, sow the seeds of peace. Absolutely. Amen. That's right.
Madam Secretary, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Mark Daniels, and I'm the eldest grandson of the inventor of something called the Ross Root Feeder. It was a tool that fed the deepest roots of trees and shrubs. About 10 years ago, I began figuring out how to take my grandfather's vision to the next level, and I came up with the idea of helping Root Feed Society. And I want to tell you just a short story about your ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to Germany, Philip Murphy. 4 years ago, he took my Weed Out Hate initiative, that of relating weeding the garden to rooting out hatred in society, with 100 immigrant children in Germany. And this was for the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And it worked lovely. Everyone understood it. In fact, I met with Charles Steele, I met with Bernard Lafayette, I even gave a Judaic tribute to Martin Luther King's visit in Germany 2 years ago. And my contribution to the campaign to you is to figure out a way so you will never have a problem with Black Lives Matter again. And this is what I want to, I brought some things for you. I brought you this shirt.
Thank you.
It says, Occupy the Dream, Weed Out Hate.
Okay.
I actually weeded out hate with hundreds of people in Ferguson in the middle of the tear gas. Black hands on white hands, rooting out weeds of hatred together, planting seeds of peace together. And by the way, the seeds of peace are coming from Earl May Seed Nursery in Shenandoah, so it's Iowa seed. It is good. And the way you can help Black Lives Matter is to get them, next time you get confronted with them, to say, come with me, let's go out to the garden. Help me root out a weed of hatred together. And I promise you, you get me into the office, and the first spring in that office, I will invite you and the head leaders of Black Lives Matter to the White House, and we will root out weeds together with a group of children in the White House, and that will be telecast and simulcast to every grade school in the United States. And instead of getting kids to pluck four-leaf clovers for luck, we're going to teach kids from the deepest roots, from my grandfather's deepest roots, from my deepest Judaic roots, to root out and compost hatred so that we all could reach for the American dream.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Wow, that's a great story. Thank you. And you know, we need a lot of reminders about what we should be doing to help each other weed out hate. That's a great metaphor. I like it, and I appreciate what you did. Phil Murphy was a great U.S. ambassador to Germany. I'm glad that you had a chance to work with him, and I hope you'll give me your information so, you know, when I'm in the White House, you can come to the garden and we'll weed out hate, and we'll get rid of it once and for all, I hope. Yes. You want to stand, and I'll hold this for you?
Thank you, President Clinton. Right. Now, I understand that the Republicans are sometimes hard to deal with, but we've got to compromise to move forward. What are we going to do about that?
Well, we're going to start by doing everything possible to build relations, even with people we don't agree with. And that goes back to the gentleman's point. If you only talk to and work with people you agree with, you will forget that much of the world may not have the same views. So I have long believed, as hard as it sometimes is, that you have to go anywhere, anytime to meet with anyone to find common ground. And I did that as First Lady, as Senator, as Secretary of State. And it was not always productive, but you can't give up on it. For example, I am passionate, as I just was saying, about healthcare. And, you know, when we weren't successful getting healthcare passed back in 93, 94, I was certainly disappointed. But then I said, okay, what can we get done? And I began working with Democrats and Republicans to pass the Children's Health Insurance Program, and it now insures 8 million children. And I was very pleased that we could find that common ground. And another issue I worked on as First Lady was with former Representative Tom DeLay. Some of you may remember, was a very conservative Republican, but cared about adoption and foster care. So I reached out to him, and I said, we probably don't agree on a lot of things, but we sure do agree on the need to improve foster care and make it possible for more children to have permanent loving homes. And we worked together, and we passed the Adoption and Safe Families Act. And then in the Senate, lots of examples, probably. To mention is working with Senator Lindsey Graham, who's now running for president on the Republican side. We both saw the same problem, that our National Guard members, me in New York, he in South Carolina, when they were deployed, often had health care problems because many of them didn't have health insurance during the rest of the time when they weren't actually deployed. So we passed an extension of what's called TRICARE to cover National Guard members. And, you know, so many examples like that, which are really part of my commitment to you, that I will work hard to find that common ground. Now, I will also stand my ground because I won't just agree with things that I don't think are good for our country. We'll have to, manage the best we can, but I will never stop talking. I will never stop reaching out. I learned that in the Senate. You can, disagree with somebody today and then be on a bill with them tomorrow. And that is the way it's supposed to work. That's the way our system is supposed to run. And I will just say this final point, and you mentioned the word. Compromise is not a dirty word in a democracy, because if you think you have all the answers, you probably belong in some other system, because our founders were madly making compromises to try to compromise between different geographic areas, different political philosophies, and they did it because they recognized that no one of us has a total understanding of everything. That should go without saying, but sometimes when I hear some of the folks in, Congress these days, I think they kind of believe they do. And we've got to break that down and begin to talk to them. We have different problems. Iowa is a different state than Texas, and Texas is a different state than New York, and New York is a different state than Montana. The genius of America is we have all of this diversity and pluralism in this incredible country of ours. And one of the ways we've been successful is to be constantly, making agreements based often on compromise. So I'm going to be doing my very best to make sure we return that to Washington. Yeah, right there. Here comes a microphone your way. You want to stand up?
My name's Colleen. I'm currently employed as a Minneapolis police officer, but I actually have a foreign policy question for you. As Secretary of State, you referred to the subjugation of women as a national security threat, yet the United States continues to ban public funding for abortion abroad with the Helms Amendment. Given that ISIS is currently using rape as a weapon of war, I was wondering what your position is on Helms as it relates to public funding for abortion for those victims who have been raped in war.
It's a really very serious question. And you said you were a police officer? Thank you. Thank you for working in law enforcement. As you know, I am pro-choice, and I am because I have, over many years, thought that it's best to leave this very difficult decision to an individual woman, her faith, her family, her physician. But it is something that is particularly important in a lot of conflict zones, and there are so many of them right now, where women are the primary victims of war, and it's not just adult women, it's girls and children. And the systematic use of rape as a tool of war and subjugation is one that has been around from the beginning of history. Those of you who studied ancient Roman history know that. But it has become even more used by a lot of the most vicious militias and insurgent groups and terrorist groups against women of different tribes, of different religions, of different, you know, geographic or national backgrounds. And I think it does pose a very, very serious question, because a lot of those women, if they are rescued, like you mentioned the Yazidi women, you know, the Yazidi women were targeted by ISIS. They were kidnapped, and they were basically either turned into slaves or given as prizes of war to ISIS fighters. Some of them eventually were rescued. Some of them escaped. And they often found themselves in the most terrible of positions, because they didn't, you know, they were pregnant and they had difficult times getting over what had happened to them and integrating into back into their communities. And it's those tough issues, those really hard, hard situations that raise the point you're raising. Because right now, the United States cannot, under our law, do anything to provide any kind of financial or medical help for a woman who has been abused like that, who finds herself pregnant. And of course, we also don't have the kind of support. I mean, it's not only that we don't have medical support, we don't have, you know, there's not like homes being opened up in these very desolate and difficult environments. It's a big problem. And I do think we have to take a look at this for conflict zones. And if the United States government, because of very strong feelings against it, maintains our prohibition, then we're going to have to work through nonprofit groups and work with other countries to at least provide the support and the medical care that a lot of these women need. I saw that in the Congo when I went to Eastern Congo, because that is still the worst of our modern conflicts. 5.5 million people killed over the last 25 years. Terrible conditions, and again, rape being used as a tool of war and subjugation. And we did come with a lot of support for hospitals and doctors who are taking care of women, but of course, we couldn't go under our law any further than that. So I think we have to, you know, we have to be honest about, if we can't help in that way, then we have to help in every other way, and we have to get other people to at least provide the options so that some of these young women, you know, they will be total outcasts. If they have the child of a terrorist or the child of a militia member, they will be a total outcast. Their families won't take them. Their communities won't take them. And so these are the kind of real-world problems that all too often don't get talked about. So thank you for raising that. Yes. Yes. Here you go.
Well, first of all, Mrs. Clinton, I have to say thank you from 8 years ago. Actually, when I went to a Barack Obama rally in Maquoketa in 2007, I told him I was supporting you, and he got along with it. So, and then you say you guys saw it, and you guys saved me a front row seat and everything, so I got to thank you for that 8 years ago. That was a lot of fun. My question is... I'm a sophomore in high school, getting ready to go to college pretty soon, and that seems to be a big problem with the debt rising and all that. And so, and you have said yourself many a times that you want affordable college with no crippling in debt. So exactly what is your plans on that?
Well, I'm glad to see you again after all these years. Could I just ask, who in this audience either has or had student debt? Okay, yeah. It's always a lot of hands go up. I had it, but it wasn't crippling. I had it to go to law school, and it was nowhere near what is now necessary, and I also had it on what's called an income contingency repayment plan. In other words, I paid it back as a percentage of my income. So when I finished law school, I went to work for the Children's Defense Fund, and I think, as I recall, I made maybe $14,000 a year, and I could do that because my debt was a percentage of the income I made, as opposed to a set amount with an interest rate that is way too high in many instances. So here's what I want to do. Number one, for those of you who are going to be starting school, I hope that my new college compact will be available to you because I want it to cover all public four-year colleges and universities. If you go to one, you will not have to borrow a dime to pay tuition. And if you have... if you have living expense issues, as we all do, if you're eligible for a Pell Grant, it will be able to be used for expenses. Right now it can't, but because we're going to make it possible for you to go debt-free to a public college or university, you'll be able to use those funds for living expenses. And I also want to get the costs of college down, and here's where I am really concerned, because the cost of college, particularly tuition and living expenses, room and board, as we used to say, have gone up so much faster than anything else in the economy. And part of it is because states no longer give what they used to give as state support for higher education. And therefore, the colleges have been continuing to face their own rising costs, and they have continued to raise tuition and other related costs. I want to work with states to incentivize them to provide more state support for higher education. It's one of the best investments any state can make. But over the last 20 years or so, a lot of states began using money for everything from highways to prisons, as opposed to keeping up their support for higher education. And I also want to work with the colleges, because I do think that colleges have to take a really hard look at their own expenses and try to get their own expenses under better control. Because some of what is being spent on more and more plant and equipment, more and more administrators, is kind of hard to justify if you're shifting all the cost onto the backs of middle class and working families who can't afford all of that. So we're going to work hard to get college affordable, to get tuition debt free, and then I want people who already have debt to be able to refinance it. You know, you can refinance your mortgage or your car payment. You ought to be able to refinance your college loans and get the interest rates down. And I am also very committed to making sure the federal government doesn't make a profit out of lending money to students and their families, because that, to me, is absolutely wrong. And I am convinced we can take that really long form, the FAFSA form, and slice it down to a reasonable amount of questions, and just not make this such an onerous and expensive process. I also want to make community college free, because it's like the additional 2 years of high school now. And I have to tell you, I've been very impressed with the community colleges that I have visited here in Iowa, Kirkwood, the Des Moines Area Community College. I've been impressed at how they are opening their doors to more and more high school students. So high school students are not only going and getting great training, and I go around bragging about Iowa everywhere. I'll just tell you, this is a little bit of an aside, but it makes my point. You all now get a third of your electricity from wind, right? And you have done it in such a smart way. And here's why. it's not only smart to harness the wind, but you also decided that the biggest cost of wind turbines was transporting them. So you are now making and assembling them in old abandoned factories. And you are now using your community colleges to train people to actually make the parts and install them and repair the turbines. So more than 7,000 people in Iowa now work in the wind turbine business. And if we did that all over the country, think of all the jobs. So the community colleges here are a great investment. And I also have met some young people who intend to go to four-year colleges. So they're going their junior and senior year to community college, getting a bunch of credits so they can start at college as juniors and save the cost of 2 years of college. So there are some really good options, and I want to make it possible for you and all of you to be able not only to afford to start, but to continue and graduate and do it without so much debt that you can't get on with your life. So that's my plan, and that's what I'm going to try to do for you. Let's see now. Okay, I see a hand. I see a hand. Yes, yes, yeah, that hand right there. Yes, sir. Yes. I'm sorry, I couldn't see whose hand it was. Yes.
My name is Hyland Nichols, and I'm a member of the Plumbers and Pipefitters Union, and we have pretty good insurance. However, in recent weeks, and past 2 years, as a matter of fact, we've taken some pretty good hits and increased some premiums. And when we ask why at the office, they say, well, it's because of the rules and regulations imposed upon us by the Affordable Health Care Act. I also have a son who recently had his situation changed. But before that, he was working for a company where he made too much money to qualify for the government assistance on buying the insurance through the Affordable Health Care Act. And he made not enough money to pay for the premiums for the policies that were being sold. So how in the world are you going to tweak and change the things in the Affordable Health Care Act that need to be fixed when you have a Congress who don't know what the word compromise even means?
Right, right. Well, you know, you do have to be something of an optimist to run for president. Because otherwise, I don't know how you'd get out of bed in the morning. You got to believe that you're going to be able to get things done. And I certainly do, because I've seen it. You know, I saw how much my husband got done. 8 years, 23 million new jobs, income rose at every level, and you know, we ended up with a balanced budget and a surplus, and I think it's fair to say that the Republicans gave them a lot of trouble. So it wasn't easy, but you get up every day and do it. I saw President Obama inherit the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression and get to work so we didn't fall into a Great Depression and get the Affordable Care Act passed, get the auto industry saved, you know, begin to crack down on Wall Street. So it's possible, and you must believe it's possible, and you must get up every day and work to make it happen. So with the Affordable Care Act, you ask two really, really important questions, because here's what I've been saying. I will defend the Affordable Care Act, but I'm going to work to improve it, because the two issues you just mentioned are among the problems that we're going to have to address. I will defend it because the Republicans want to repeal it, and they don't give you any alternative as to what they would put in its place. And we will go back to even more problems, because the insurance companies will call all of the shots. And if you have a pre-existing condition, your insurance will likely be, you know, unaffordable or only affordable with a big cost attached. Women will go back to paying more for our health insurance than men, which is the way it was, and a lot of other problems. So the first part of your question is referring to what was called the Cadillac tax. Have you heard that phrase? And it was because especially unions bargained hard for health care. I mean, remember how health care through your employer got started in our country? It got started during World War II. when employers had to compete for the workforce they needed because so many were in our military, obviously, millions and millions, but we still had to keep the economy going and partly had to keep it going to, you know, provide what the military needed. So as an incentive to attract and keep workers, employers started offering health insurance. That's how we got into this tradition of getting your health insurance primarily from your work. Well, unions, in their collective bargaining, bargain for really good health care. And that good health care was part of the bargain, you know, because your wages were, to an extent, less than they might have been because the money instead went into paying for the health care. So under the Affordable Care Act, there is a provision that people with really, really good expensive health insurance benefits, primarily but not exclusively organized labor, would have to begin paying, in effect, a tax on that amount, on up to a certain amount of their health insurance. The theory was that, oh, okay, if the cost of health insurance goes down for people in organized labor, then labor can bargain for higher wages. That's the theory. I don't buy the theory. That's why I am in favor of repealing what's called the Cadillac tax, because I don't think it will translate into higher wages. So it will be a tax to lower the health benefits that you bargain for without seeing an increase in your wages. So I'm against that. Now, we have to find another way to plug the hole left in terms of funding the Affordable Care Act, because it does help to provide the subsidies and some of the other support. But I don't believe it's fair to impose that burden on plans that were the result of bargaining. Now, your son has another problem. Your son's problem, which I hear a lot about, is that he makes too much money to qualify for the subsidy if you got your insurance through the exchange. But he doesn't make enough money to afford to buy an insurance policy without a subsidy. So he's like in a catch-22. So one of the fixes we've got to make to the Affordable Care Act is getting more insurance competition and getting more help with out-of-pocket expenses so that somebody like your son, who's right now caught in this, you know, dilemma, can have the choice to actually be able to afford health insurance. So that is one of the fixes that I am proposing. Another problem with the Affordable Care Act are the really high deductibles on some of the plans. And I was meeting with a mother whose son has a very serious lifelong medical condition, and her husband has good insurance, but the deductible is $10,000. And, you know, this young man needs a lot of treatment. So they run out of their deductible by March. That's how much they spend just in 3 months. And then they have to keep going for the rest of the year. So we've got to look at the deductible costs, the premium costs, the out-of-pocket expenses. Now, these are all fixable problems. But as you point out, the Republicans have voted nearly 60 times to repeal it without putting anything in its place. So in order to get these changes made, I'm going to have to figure out how to get those through the Congress. If you open up the Affordable Care Act, they may not be so cooperative, and we may end up with something that isn't good for people. So that's the kind of dilemma that I know I will face as president. But I am determined to confront a lot of these issues, the two you raised and others have raised with me. Now, obviously, it would be easier for me if we could get a Democratic Senate, then at least I'd have one house that I could work with, and then we could maybe work with the other house as well. Yeah, right there. Yeah. Here comes a microphone.
Excuse me. I got it. I really have four things to say. I'm so excited that you're running for president. And one thing that I really think should be changed is with SSI and SSD. How, for me as a single mom, I struggle. I'm on SSD and SSD, SSI and SSD. And I'm bipolar, and it's really hard for me to be in the work environment, and it's really struggling for me to talk to you right now because it's very scary for me. My son is high-function autistic and ADHD, and I have a beautiful daughter and Steph's sister, or half-sister, sorry. And I struggle every month to month because we are only allowed to have a certain amount every month with disability. You're only capped out to have like 2,000 to 3,000 depending if you're married. And it's a really, really struggle, and I wish that for me as a mom, I can get a house. It's a struggle. And because I would love to have a yard for my kids to be able to play in and have a garage, you know, just like a playground in the backyard. But it's a struggle. I also see, my second thing is on Facebook, I see how parents or people will put about food stamps and how parents misuse it. I'm a parent that doesn't. And the prices of the food in our stores are so high that I have to refuse to get the hamburger when I see it $3.49 or $4.99, depending where it is. And I always have to wait for the sales and then stock up on it when it's on the sales. And it's so hard. And with me getting SSI and SSD, there's at points where I'm only getting $50 for food stamps. And it's a struggle for me because I want to eat healthy. I don't want to be obese. But that's where I am because there's no help in that at all for parents that want to eat healthy. And my third thing is bullying. My son gets bullied a lot at school because of his autism and not understanding about his disability that he has. And I wish that they had groups that would, you know, inspire kids that have autism or different, that are disabilities, that could be there as a support instead of bringing them down and understanding, hey, my son has a tic, so he might do this little fidgeting and stuff like that. I wish that, you know, there's other kids that can inspire other kids to, hey, let's stand up and be their friend instead of making them feel down. So those are my three things.
Get another one. Oh, here it goes. It's on again. What I was saying to this young woman is I think she's really brave to stand up and say these things. But I think it's also important that you did that because what you said about how difficult it is to make the decisions you have to make as a mom with your own medical condition, with your son's medical challenges, with the difficulty of getting the support that you need to be able to eat healthy, as you say, and then the problems with bullying and some of the other challenges that your son faces. You know, I am going to do everything I can as president to deal with all of these big issues, and I want to say a quick word about mental health because she said she's bipolar. You know, we passed a law that called for what is labeled parity. Parity. So you're supposed to treat mental health the same as any other condition. But we don't. Insurance companies really don't like to pay for mental health treatment. Lots of times it's difficult for somebody who has some condition to get constant, continuing medical care. The pharmaceuticals that may or may not be prescribed are expensive, and it's also important that you're followed up because you should be following the regimen, and if you don't, that can cause other problems. So we have a lot of challenges with untreated mental health issues in our country, and you know, I obviously don't know anything of your situation, but the diagnosis bipolar is one that requires a lot of support and a lot of follow-up. And I'm worried that our failure to treat mental health is just causing more pain, suffering, and costing us more money. I was very much against what your governor did when he vetoed the compromise, the Republican and Democratic compromise, you know, to keep 2 out of your 4 mental health facilities open. And I have on very reliable information that many of the people in the mental health facilities that were closed were moved into nursing homes. That is not the proper setting for somebody with some kind of mental illness. And it's also really dangerous because you're not treating the person who has the mental illness correctly. And you probably don't have people trained to do that with respect to the other patients. So this is the kind of budgetary decision that can have really long-lasting impacts, both in human terms and economic terms. I still think there's a stigma about mental illness. And it's wrong that there's a stigma. A friend of mine has this great phrase. She says, you know, you should treat illness from the neck up the same as you treat illness from the neck down. And think about that. If you have diabetes or you have cancer, you're going to get help. You have bipolar or depression or panic attacks or anxiety or schizophrenia, it's going to be really unpredictable whether you get help and whether you get continuing help. So I'm not speaking to your specific situation, but I do believe that, you know, someone in your position with a diagnosed mental health challenge, you know, needs the kind of support that can only come from constant care and follow-up. And then with your son, look, I was the first presidential candidate back in 08 to roll out a policy on autism. I'm going to do it again. I'm updating it. I will be rolling out a policy on autism. This is a very serious and challenging condition because of the spectrum, you know, the Asperger autism spectrum. Some people are very high functioning. Some people are very much suffering under all kinds of disabilities, and there's everything in between. But one thing we know is that you want to try to help a family early do everything it can to try to better prepare their autistic child to be able to be as successful as possible. And as you say, your son now is in school. But if he is not treated fairly, if he is bullied, if he is mistreated, you know, that is not going to be helpful to him in trying to get him to go as far as he's capable of going and to be as independent as he's capable of being. So I think we all have to recognize the difficulties that autism poses, and there is an uptick in the numbers of people being diagnosed with autism, and there's a lot of different theories about why that may be the case, including that, you know, perhaps people who were high functioning were never given a diagnosis. They were just people who, you know, were good at math or good at science or good at music or whatever it might have been, and people knew that they might have some, you know, unusual characteristics, but it wasn't a medical diagnosis. So we have a lot of work to do. And to deal with mental health, to deal with autism, to deal with, you know, the financial challenges that somebody like you faces in trying to support yourself and your children, and, you know, to give you as many opportunities to be as self-sufficient as you can be, given your own condition. And that takes good care and constant care that can give you both the confidence and the competence to go into the wider world, and I hope you can get that. Yes.
Good to meet you. Nice to see you. My name is Melody, and I'm an SEIU nurse. And, oh, I don't know, a billion years ago, I began my career as a nurse at a VA hospital. And my dad is a veteran. My brothers are veterans. I have cousins and friends who are veterans, and I really am distressed at the lack of support that this current Congress is showing to our veterans with their health care. And I would like to know what you plan to do about that.
Yes, thank you, Melody. Thank you very much. Thank you. You know, I'm proud to have SEIU's endorsement, and I'm proud to work with you on a lot of the issues that are important to health care and home health care and child care and all the other important concerns. You know, I agree that the VA deserves our support, and when there are problems in it, and some were discovered a few years ago, systemic problems, they need to be addressed, they need to be rooted out, they need to be fixed so that all of our veterans get the health care they deserve in a timely fashion. I personally think that the new administrator, Mr. McDaniel, is really trying to do that, really trying to go after those problems. But unfortunately, the Republicans and some outside interests, like the Koch brothers, have taken this problem that needs to be addressed and are trying to use it as a reason to privatize the VA. And I have rolled out a veterans policy that covers a lot of these issues. You can go to my website, hillaryclinton.com, and look at it, because I do think that many of the most important services that veterans need, not just our young vets, but our older vets as well, are really best provided through the VA. And you actually can see some of the specialized care, like probably nobody in our country does prosthetics as well as the VA. There are psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers who deal with PTSD or deal with traumatic brain injury, but not in the number and not with the experience base that you have at the VA. So there is a lot that is really good and effective about the VA, and like any other institution, we have to fix what's broken but not break what works. So I will do everything in my power to fix any problems in the VA, but I will stand against these Republican efforts to privatize the VA, which would mean the end of the kind of specialty care that our veterans now receive. So let's see. Oh, yeah, there are some hands way in the back. I feel terrible. Okay, we've got, I saw two hands waving, this young lady there and the young lady standing. So I'll take two questions from both of you there in the back.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. I wanted to ask, as a New York senator, you fought for state farmers to supply food to local schools, restaurants, and colleges. Well, on the national level, how will you emerge to support small and family-owned farms when you become president?
Oh, I love that question. Thank you. I love that question. That was one of the best parts of my being a senator from New York. Now, I have to stop and say, I bet a lot of you don't know we have farms in New York. You know, we really do. We have a lot of farms, mostly dairy, fruit, and vegetable. And I got very interested when I was, you know, spending a lot of time in my first campaign traveling around the state talking to farmers, and they are predominantly small family-owned farms. And so when I got to the Senate, I started talking to the Ag Committee and others about how we need to do more to help what are called specialty crops, fruit and vegetables, and what we can do about dairy. And they would just look at me and laugh, and they'd say, Why are you interested in this? And I said, well, because we have all these farms. And they just wouldn't take me seriously. So one day I gave a speech on the Senate floor, and I talked about all the farms, all the statistics, and all, you know, we have 17th generation farmers still in New York. I mean, it's really wonderful. So anyway, I gave this speech, and I had some charts, and one of my charts was of a cow. And I said, you know, we are second. At that time, we were second in the country in the production of milk. So anyway, I finished my speech, and I felt really good about it because I thought, you know, I'm really helping to explain about our farms. And a senator who shall remain nameless, but from a large Midwestern farming state, He came up to me and he goes, okay, so you have one cow in New York. I mean, really. But we did start to work together. And one of the things that I did was to look for ways to connect up small family farms with schools, hospitals, other local institutions to get more direct sales. And then I began to link up what we call in New York downstate, New York City restaurants with farmers in New York. And it was just one of the most fun things I did, because I went to a lot of the New York City restaurants and I said, where do you get your fruits and vegetables? Where do you get your cheeses? And they got them from a lot of places, but they didn't get them from upstate New York. I said, well, why is that? And some of them said, well, we didn't really know who to call, or we didn't have any entree. Some of them said, well, you know, we've tried to buy corn from upstate farmers, but they insist on, you know, putting it in burlap bags, and we can't unload burlap bags in New York City because, you know, we're pulling them out so fast, a lot of them break, and they need to put them in crates like they do in Pennsylvania. Anyway, I just learned all this stuff about it. And then I took up a bunch of New York restaurateurs, and we did a little tour of upstate New York, because the other thing that we're, you know, pretty well known for is wine. And so I said, yeah, you know, you need to buy more New York wine and all the rest of it. Bottom line is, I will do whatever I can through the USDA to do more to support these kinds of connections. Maybe have some, online programs where people can, you know, check in and figure out what's being sold where, what the price is, what the transportation costs would be. Just anything we can do to get more purchases where appropriate, directly with small farmers. Now, it's different in New York, I know, than it is in Iowa, because, you know, you have row crops and it's a different kind of farming, and it may not be as accessible to do what I tried to do in New York. I want to finish with two quick stories, though, because it's really, we really had a great time. So Cornell University has a wonderful School of Agriculture and great cooperative extension service hub, and runs all of the co-ops around the state. So I had a meeting. I had a meeting at Cornell with the experts, the professors and others, and a lot of the farmers with the New York Farm Bureau and others. And I brought up some of the New York food brokers. Honestly, I wish I had it on videotape. A lot of the New York food brokers, you know, showed up. They had more gold on than you see in a, you know, a queen. Necklaces and big rings. And, you know, the farmers are sitting across the table and they're looking at these guys and then they're looking at me. And it was like my first exercise in diplomacy. I'd like you to meet the broker from the Bronx. I'd like you to meet the farmer from, you know, Ithaca. And it was a culture shock for both sides. And that's part of what I did, was to try to be the translator. And the final thing I'll say is, I started having a New York Farm Day at the Capitol in my continuing effort to convince my colleagues we had farms. So we'd bring in all of these products, and then I'd invite all the senators and their staffs, and we'd have a great time for a couple of hours on a day in probably October, late October or so. So one day, the party had been going on for quite some time, and there was this wonderful little dairy, a little family dairy with their own herd, and they produced really good ice cream. And they were next to, in the booth, a New York winery that produced ice wine. So one of the fellows who was at the party was going around tasting everything, and he got to the ice cream, and he said, oh, I want some of that ice cream. He said, can I pour some wine on top? Sure, why not? So he poured the wine on top, and he said, this is great. So then he started telling me, pretty soon there was this crowd around the ice cream and the wine people, and after it was all over, the woman who ran the dairy came up to me and she goes, people really loved that. Do you think that there'd be a market for it? I said, I don't know, but let's find out. So I helped her. She is now exporting wine ice cream all over the world. And so it's the kind of connections that can make a difference, right? So I know we've got to go, but I told the other young woman whose hand was up. Okay, I'll take one last question, but you've all been so wonderful and patient tonight. Thanks.
Hello. My name is Malik Usmanova, and I'm a freshman at the University of Iowa. I have a question for you about immigrants and their education. I'm very lucky that I came here with the help of my parents completely legally, and I'm able to pursue my dreams in the United States. However, I know many children are not that lucky. My question for you is, there are many, many illegal immigrant children who did not decide to come to the United States, but now that they are here, they've accepted it as their country, and many times English is the only language they know, and American culture is what they take as their own. How can we help these children further their future in the United States, and so help America further?
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I think it's been quite a sign of great restraint that nobody is in any of the Iowa sweatshirts or the University of Iowa people said, you know, we're undefeated. I'm going to get to your question because it's a very serious question, but I was thinking when you said University of Iowa, you know, my husband is a fanatic football follower, college and professional. And, you know, about 3 weeks ago, he goes, you know, he said, I think Iowa's real for real. And I said, yeah, I mean, it looks like it. And he goes, you know, because he's going to campaign for me, but he's got a lot of other things he has to finish first. He goes, I'm wondering whether I can get there before the season is over. And I said, well, let's try to figure that out, but we'll work on it. Look, I think your question goes right to the heart of why we need comprehensive immigration reform. And for me, it is because we do have, you know, so many people here, particularly young people, who did not come here on their own. They came because their parents brought them or sent for them. And this is the only country they know. This is the country that they pledge allegiance to. It is the language that they have learned. And that's why I support what the president did on the Dreamers, to give these young people a chance to make their mark and their contribution here. And I just want to tell you a quick story. I've met with a lot of Dreamers over the last years, and I'm very impressed by their strong desire to make a contribution. I've met, you know, kids who were brought here by their parents serving in our military and putting their lives on the line. I've met kids who graduate at the top of their high school class and then, you know, find it really difficult to go on to college because of the barriers that exist. Or they graduate from college and then they find it difficult to get a job, and it goes on and on. So I think we have to be really open and understanding of who these folks are, these 11 million people who are here in our country undocumented. And I think if we do that, we realize that actually immigration, these people, their parents, the folks who are working, has really helped our economy. And a lot of people kind of overlook that. They also contribute $12 billion into Social Security that they're never going to get out because they're not eligible. If we add comprehensive immigration reform, while they were still on a path to citizenship, because I believe there has to be a path, but it has to be a path where, yes, they have to learn English. Yes, they have to, make a contribution. They have to pay a fine. I have a whole set of ideas about the best way to do this. But they will. But if made possible to be on that path, they would be contributing an additional $20 billion a year. So there are a lot of benefits to legalizing the undocumented immigrants who are here today. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, I don't recognize we need an immigration system that works, but actually there is now no net immigration from Mexico because the Mexican economy is actually picked up. People have gone home. People are now returning back to Mexico. So we have stabilized our situation with Mexico. Our biggest flow of refugees now comes from Central America and Latin America. And part of that is working with them to get their own economies and their governments to work more effectively. But that doesn't answer the problem. The future issues we have to deal with doesn't answer the problem of what we do with the people who are here today. And I will continue to advocate for and work for comprehensive immigration reform and do everything I can to protect these young people who, for all intents and purposes, are Americans because this is the only country they've ever known. This is where they've gone to school. This is where they got their first jobs. And I think it would be a great loss to us if we don't make it possible for them to become citizens. Thank you all very much. We were born to be fine.